From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan gets its first confirmed case of measles as state health officials worry about unvaccinated kids.
Very concerned. Measles is not a disease to take lightly. It's a very serious disease.
We call it wild rice. Michigan's native tribes call it manumen, and it has a long, sacred history.
This area in the Great Lakes Basin is the only place that this manumen grows on Mother Earth.
Plus the history of Faygo.
Harry started baking in Detroit, and he got so sick and tired of baker's hours that he called his brother up, and they decided to get out of baking and get into pop making.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the year 2000, health officials declared measles had been eliminated in the United States. 19 years later, over 200 cases of measles have been confirmed in more than a dozen states, many in the Pacific Northwest. Today, we report the first case of measles to be reported in Michigan, a travel-related case out of Oakland County. State health officials have posted locations where people may have been exposed to the measles virus. Michigan is one of 17 states that allows parents to opt out of vaccinating their kids for religious or philosophical reasons. And within these states, vaccine rates in some areas can be lower than what health officials feel is ideal. Oakland County has one of the highest rates of vaccine waivers in Southeast Michigan. Bob Swanson is with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, where he directs the Division of Immunization. Bob, as the number of measles cases increases through the nation, how worried are you that we'll have an outbreak in Michigan?
Very concerned. Measles is not a disease to take lightly. It's a very serious disease, and we need to put measures in place just to make sure that we don't have cases.
And which leads us to talk about herd immunity. It remind us what this is and why it matters in slowing the spread of an infectious disease like measles and also protecting people who cannot get vaccinated for medical reasons.
Sure. So measles is a very communicable disease. It's spread very easily to the point that you can have an individual who is ill with measles and they can leave the room and 2 hours later somebody could come into that room and still catch the virus. It's a very viable virus that spreads very, very easily. I've seen different numbers, 95 to 96%, that you need the population to be immune, because herd immunity is the fact that you have a large number of individuals within a community who are immune to a disease. And if you've got large numbers that are immune to the disease, it makes it less likely that that disease will spread from one individual to another. It doesn't get embedded into the community, and we see large numbers spread. So the higher number that we can have vaccinated, which we call herd immunity, the better off we are in preventing the spread to the general public and on beyond. It is important that we keep those numbers up, because there are individuals within the population who can't be vaccinated. Normally, because of medical reasons, they can't be vaccinated. They could have an allergy maybe to a vaccine and can't, or maybe they're immune suppressed on chemotherapy, something like that. They can't be vaccinated. So not only are they susceptible to the disease, but most likely if they get the disease, it's going to be more serious because of their weakened immune system.
Clark County in Washington State is pretty much the epicenter of this Pacific Northwest outbreak, and that's where more than 20% of kindergartners didn't have all their vaccines when they started school. Do we have pockets in Michigan where the vaccination rate is so low that you're worried?
We do. There are areas of the state where our waiver rate, so that's the number of individuals within a school who may have opted out of vaccines, where those waiver rates are higher than other areas of the state. And so that is very concerning to us, that you've got a community where a lot of individuals are opting out of vaccines, and that just takes one exposure that could introduce the disease to that area.
Where are those pockets?
Well, they really are spread throughout the state, and some of them are very, very local, just within a school, that it could be one school that has low rates, but they really are spread throughout the state in some areas. We tend to have higher immunization rates sort of in the southwest corner of Michigan, We're concerned about some of the rural areas that have lower immunization rates as well. So, you know, I can't put my finger on just one spot.
When you talk with parents who are vaccine hesitant parents, they choose not to vaccinate their kids. Where are they getting their information?
It's from a variety of sources. I think that a lot of it comes off the web and information that's shared among other individuals who are hesitant to get vaccines. That's where a good part of it comes from. There are a lot of other sources, too, but I feel that we've got good, sound information about how effective and how safe vaccines really are. You know, it's one of the biggest public health accomplishments in eliminating these once very threatening, deadly diseases, and we don't hear of them very much. I think that sometimes people that are hesitant about vaccines don't quite understand how serious these diseases can be. We don't have them as often as we did, and so people aren't as afraid. And when they're out of sight, they're out of mind, they don't feel that it's as important to get vaccinated, that it wouldn't be their child maybe that would get sick. But that's very concerning to us at the state.
So how do you effectively get that message to these vaccine-hesitant parents?
We try to do it through different venues like our I Vaccinate campaign, which we've partnered with the Frame Strong Foundation on. The I Vaccinate campaign is a central place where parents can go for information, positive information about immunizations and facts about immunizations, and learn the benefits of vaccines. The Frame Strong Foundation is set up by a mother and father who were affected by vaccine-preventable diseases and want to make sure that others have the right information to make a good decision about immunizations.
Bob Swanson is with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. He directs the Division of Immunization. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
The UAW has wrapped up its special bargaining convention with promises of a tough fight at the bargaining table later this year. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And Daniel, pretty tough talk this week at Cobo Center. You've got UAW President Gary Jones vowing to use every last ounce of the union's might to save the plants that are set to be idled and preserve job security. These should be good times for the union, but the tone was confrontational. Why is that?
Well, the tone is kind of always confrontational every 4 years, and particularly since we've come out of the global financial meltdown. You know, this is will be the second contract negotiation where the unions are again allowed to strike coming out of the meltdown and the bailouts. In, I think, 2009 and 2011, they were barred from striking as a result of the federal bailout. So I think this is fairly predictable that the union would take this position. They're going to say they're going to save these plants. Whether they will or they won't remains to be seen. That's all going to be in the details of whether there can be investment, new investment in Lordstown, Ohio, or in Detroit Hamtramck, which would be the two main ones. And then there's two transmission operations, one in Warren in southeast Michigan and the other in Baltimore. I would expect that at least three of those don't survive, but I think that remains to be seen. This also has to be put under the condition that the union is staring at a continuing federal criminal investigation.
Yeah, let's talk about that cloud of that federal corruption investigation. It's just hanging over the union. Remind us just what that's uncovered.
Well, it focused primarily on the Fiat Chrysler UAW National Training Center, which is located downtown. And the former top labor negotiator of FCA, a guy by the name of Alphonse Iacobelli, is sitting in federal prison as we speak now, having been convicted of diverting money from the accounts to pay for a lot of luxuries in his life, from Mont Blanc pens to a Ferrari to renovations at his home to, I think, paying off the student loans of his daughter. The wife of a former vice president of the Fiat Chrysler department, her name is Monica Morgan Holyfield, she also has been convicted of doing that. But this is not over. I mean, the union has taken a position publicly in the last year or so saying, these were a couple of bad apples. No dues money was used because these training centers are funded by appropriations effectively from the automakers. So it's actually corporate money that goes into these centers that funds these centers and the activities of these centers. We've since found out in other reporting that it would appear that there has been dues money used in things from very extravagant conferences out in Palm Springs every year, meals, booze, all sorts of other things that have been repeated. And there are allegations in court that other people have been involved in receiving monies from the training center. That is yet to be adjudicated. But I think where we stand right now is the federal investigation is not over. It's still very much active.
And how is that all hitting the rank and file, do you think?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think one thing it clearly does is it confirms one of the worst fears that you hear from time to time from the rank and file, and that is that the leadership is more interested in enriching themselves than they are enriching the members who pay dues to have these leaders look out for them. Fundamentally, the government is arguing that this whole moving about of money corrupted the bargaining process. And they have alleged in papers, and it's interesting how they do this, they will essentially ratchet up arguments over time in various filings. We finally found in one of the filings that they basically accused the United Auto Workers as an institution and Fiat Chrysler as a corporation of conspiring together to essentially spread the wealth around, and that it had corrupted the bargaining process. That's ultimately where I think the feds want to go, is to say this corrupted the bargaining process, is therefore is a violation of federal labor law, and down the road we go. They also are looking at the training centers of General Motors and Ford, but it's important to note that both of those training centers have been audited by the financial organizations of the automakers themselves on an annual basis. Until this was uncovered at Fiat Chrysler, their books were not audited by the corporation. Mm. And therefore, there were less controls in place, because essentially the corporations look at this and say, this is our money. So we need to know how it's spent and track it. And they've done that. So whether or not this they actually find stuff in terms of GM and Ford, I think remains to be seen. The expectation is they probably won't, but I don't think we can say categorically, because as you know, when we look at what's happening with President Trump and all those investigations, we don't know what the people that have subpoena power may know.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, the flavorful history of Faygo, one of Detroit's most iconic companies.
One flavor actually exploded in the bottles, and that was the pineapple orange, which unfortunately was initially made with unpasteurized pineapple juice.
That story next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Want a happy trip down memory lane? Here you go.
Remember when you were a kid? Well, part of you still is. And that's why we make Faygo.
That jingle represents one of Detroit's most iconic companies, Faygo, born on Detroit's east side more than 100 years ago. And Faygo Pop is still being bottled there. Michigan State University journalism professor Joe Grimm has written a history of the company appropriately titled The Faygo Book. Joe Grimm, good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
What inspired you to write The Faygo Book?
Well, one story is I think it was because I got so thirsty writing about Coney Islands. But it could be that it's because of commercials like that that I grew up really loving Faygo.
I, too, grew up drinking it, watching those commercials. For anyone who didn't do that and might not be familiar with Faygo, it is Detroit's pop. And, Joe, isn't Faygo the reason that we call it pop and not soda?
Actually, that's not quite true. Pop had been called that for a long time before Faygo came. But Faygo has been ahead of most any other company in insisting that we call it pop. And because of that, the Detroit area calls it pop more frequently than any other part of the country.
Now, tell us about the two immigrant brothers from Russia, how they came to Detroit and then hit on the idea of, instead of baking, making soda pop.
Well, Ben and Perry Fagenson came and arrived first in Cleveland, and then the older brother, Perry, moved to Detroit. Ben stayed back in Cleveland working for his in-laws who had a pop company. Perry started baking in Detroit, and he got so sick and tired of baker's hours that he called his brother up and they decided to get out of baking and get into pop making. And for their first flavors, they actually used frosting recipes.
I love it. What were those first Faygo flavors?
There were three: fruit punch, strawberry, which we call red pop, and grape.
That was, I know they launched the company November 4th, 1907. How long before the brothers realized that they had something that people wanted to buy and this was a product that was going to last?
Well, it didn't come right away, but by 1912, they had enough money that they were buying a truck instead of delivering everything in a horse wagon. So I think within a few years, with Detroit's population just booming, they figured it out and they started investing.
How did the growth of Faygo mirror the social and economic changes that were happening in Detroit in the early 20th century?
Well, it's interesting because the company for its entire life has stayed in a very small area on Detroit's Near East Side in what was the Jewish enclave and then became the African-American neighborhood, the only one in the city at that time. And the area was growing so quickly that Faygo grew right along with it. And as the city's population peaked and then began to decline, Faygo started thinking about how can we find more markets.
And how did they go about that?
Well, this was a real challenge because they were very loyal to their East Side neighborhood and their employees were loyal to them. And they felt that to get the land they needed to build a bigger plant, they might have to move out of the city. So this was a real struggle between loyalty and what they thought was their new destiny.
Yeah, how did it get resolved?
Well, it's kind of surprising. What happened was Mort Fagenson, who was part of the second generation of Fagensons to run the company, decided that the gas crisis was making it unwise to expand and run trucks all over the country. They said, well, we're going to stay right here. We're going to continue to bottle mostly in Detroit. They're in about 40-some states now, but they do not have big distribution centers all around the country. And as it turned out, in the 1980s, the Fagenson family sold the company to a company called TreeSweet, which little did they know was on its way into bankruptcy. And TreeSweet held Faygo for just 14 months before National Beverage came along and sort of rescued everything by buying the company.
I want to circle back, though, to that second generation. It's interesting.
Sure.
We see this story a lot where somehow that second generation handoff is sometimes when companies founder and fail. So what was different here with this second generation?
Well, they were very lucky that they had a pretty big group of people coming behind the founders, those brothers. And so they were able to pass the company to two brothers and a cousin, Mort, Herman, and Phil, who were veterans of World War II, decorated veterans, I might say. And after they came back from the war, they were at the right age to take over the company from Perry, the surviving brother.
It was in good, able hands.
It was in good hands, and they were ready to go.
Now, I'm interested, as you did your research, Joe Grimm, into Faygo, what have been some of the most successful and iconic Faygo flavors, and what are some of the ones that flopped?
Oh, that's a very good question. Top of most everybody's list has got to be Red Pop, of course, and it had a good push from advertising, and it's a great flavor. Rock and Rye is very popular. Faygo has won national awards for its root beer and its orange. A flavor that did not do well was a apple pop called Eve. You can't find that anywhere. And one flavor actually exploded in the bottles, and that was the pineapple orange, which unfortunately was initially made with unpasteurized pineapple juice.
Ooh, and it exploded in the bottles, so that didn't work so well.
It was a big mess. It was busting out the lights in the factory. It was banned from Dearborn. They had to drive around and pick up all this messy, these exploded bottles, and remake the pop then with pasteurized pineapple juice.
We're seeing Americans become much more aware of the health impacts of too much sugar and moving away from soda and towards water. Some places, some cities have put in sugar taxes. How is Faygo responding to those challenges?
The soft drink business is very hard, I would say. There's been problems with sweeteners, and of course, those are related to all kinds of health concerns, whether it's an artificial sweetener or like a cane sugar. Pop consumption is down, and the way that Faygo has been responding is they were one of the first companies to really get into the diet business, and that helped them because they were responding in a positive way. They were able to quickly turn things around because they had chemists and scientists and flavor masters in their factory. And when cyclamates were banned, Faygo came out right away before almost anybody else with new flavors that were cyclamate free. But it's still a tough business. People are moving more and more to sparkling waters and tea and other beverages.
Is there a sense that you were able to get through all of your research as far as the long-term outlook for this iconic company?
Well, one thing that really helps Faygo these days is that National Beverage is the manufacturer of LaCroix, which owns about 20 or 25% of the sparkling water market. So that could help Faygo that it's in with another beverage that is aimed for the future.
What most surprised you as you worked on this book? What'd you learn?
I was really happy to discover the loyalty that ran through the company. The first generation ran the company for 40 years, and so did the second generation. And many, many employees worked there for 30, 40, 50 years. And that was a nice surprise. And another one was the fact that the Fagansons employed a lot of African-American people because of the neighborhood they were in. And they stuck by those people, even when new unions and some of their customers objected to the number of black employees they had.
Interesting. And as we see in your book, Faygo's fourth factory, the present factory, still turning out pop on Detroit's east side. What's your favorite Faygo flavor?
Oh, I have a lot, but my top flavor is rock and rye.
Rock and rye, and I'm a cream soda girl.
That's a good flavor.
MSU journalism professor Joe Grimm, his new book is The Faygo Book, taking us into the iconic Detroit company that's been churning out pop for over a century. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
When you're taking the first steps down a career path, it can feel like taking a leap into the unknown. And that's probably especially true when your career isn't just a job. It's a lifelong spiritual commitment. Today, for our Work in Progress series, we'll hear from two Catholic priests, one recently ordained, the other recently retired.
And may the Lord bless both of us, the Father
and the Son. May you be in our thoughts during this time, on our lips and in our hearts. Let us think like you, let us love like you, and let us live like you. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Father. My name is Father James Hobeck, or Father Jim. I'm from Church of the Holy Family in Novi, and I'm very grateful to be just a newly ordained priest.
And I'm Father Ed Pruce, and I've been a priest for 57 years.
57 years.
And I retired now and living in St. James Church in Ferndale, which is now called our Mother Perpetual Help.
Just some questions I'd like to ask you. What were some of the best parts or things that you can remember of being a priest? Like, what would be your, would you say, one or two strengths?
You know, Jim, I never thought I could do certain things, but I was amazed. Like, my first assignment, I went to into the city of Detroit. I rang the doorbell. This elderly man answered the door, and I said, "Father Uhlenberg?" He said, "Yes." And the first words he said to me were, "Your day off is Tuesday." But to do the things that all of a sudden, I had never done these things before. I remember sick calls. I especially remember sick calls. And there was a little book that had the ritual for what to do when someone is sick, and they called you as a priest. I'd study that in Latin all the time. How about yourself? I mean, these first weeks and months are exciting times. What's been going on for you?
Really, it's just learning on the fly. So I had the privilege of being ordained at the church at Holy Family in Novi, and it was a beautiful experience. But the next thing you know, Monday came, and I was the associate pastor. You know, I had phone calls, emails, people asking me to do masses here, there, and everywhere. I was very excited to hear confessions. And so for me, it's been a very quick learning curve. And I would say that, in truth, like, life has been very busy. You know, there's been a lot of activities, also, too, we have the Spanish Mass every
you
Saturday.
You speak Spanish?
Oui. Un poquito, you know. And that's a challenge. I took 4 years of French in high school. There was something I was hoping to do. But in truth, my grasp isn't great. I probably speak like a child, but I'm open to learning. I'm open to practicing and to learn. So these first few months of priesthood have been incredible. So Father Proust, just wondering, how has the life of a priest changed? You know, you were ordained 57 years ago. What do you think it looked like back in the 1960s as opposed to here in 2018?
When I was ordained, our understanding and appreciation of the priesthood, at least mine, was that we were supposed to be doing everything. And what has happened is amazing, that it's like the Spirit of God in the people of God has just called their gifts forth. And so all of a sudden now you have people who are ministers of the Eucharist. I mean, that was not even imagined at the start with us. Only the priest could distribute the Holy Eucharist. Only the priest did the readings at Mass, led the prayers. All these gifts that have been buried in the community, all those years, you know, and people just came and it's like the church has come alive.
What would be one important piece of advice to give me?
You know what, Jim? I'd say this. Love the people. I was in the hospital. I had to get an X-ray taken. And the woman who's taking the information says to me, "Are you Father Proust, who used to be at Shrine?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "You married me." I said, "I did." She said, "Yeah." I said, "How's your married life? Did it work out?" And she said, "It was marvelous. My husband has passed away, but I have two beautiful daughters now, and we've had a wonderful life." Just to meet people like that, it's always the voice of God in our lives. You know, people are really marvelous, and there's so much goodness in them. And all we have to do is, we're like the treasure finders for God. That would be my advice.
Thank you. I do appreciate that. It's important, because I'm learning, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the things that I always wonder about when talking with the young priest is like, was this a difficult decision? Because in our society, you know, like priesthood was considered, I don't know, just it was treated with awe, if I can say that word. It was something that people looked forward to. In this day and age, though, the way society is, people say, "Why would you become a priest?" And I wonder if that was hard for you. To be a priest in today's world is a challenge.
Yeah. There's no doubt about that at all. I mean, when I was in high school, that was something I had to wrestle with. Is like, back when I was a senior, that's when I first started thinking about priesthood. And one of the challenges a lot of my buddies would ask is like, "Well, you're never going to get married. You're never going to have kids. You can't have sex. You're not going to be able to live." And I remember even at that point in time, that didn't sound right to me, but I wasn't able to articulate a response. But that's something that during my time of seminary, I did have to wrestle and pray about, is that, yeah, if I'm going to be a priest, there is great sacrifice, that I will not have a wife, I will not have a girlfriend, that as a celibate man, I will live on my own. And one of the biggest obstacles I had to get over was that looking at it, rather than being a prohibition or a condition, a freedom. And so for me, yeah, there is an incredible need for courage to be able to be firm in my commitment to celibacy, to live chastely, to recognize that a lot of the culture around us mocks or doesn't value chastity. They look at it as a chain or something that enslaves people. But instead, there's actually great freedom, you know, to love not just, you know, people as objects, but people as persons.
It takes courage. But that's true of all vocations. It takes courage. And You know, so often people say, well, you're not going to have any children or and you're not going to have a family like other people have, but all families become yours.
Well, Father Preuss, I just want to say thank you. I told you that there are a number of priests who are somewhat jealous that they couldn't be here talking with you, but you've got a ton of experience, a ton of wisdom to share, and in this brief period of time, you did. And all I can say to you is thank you. I'm very humbled to be here just to share this time with you, and I do ask that you please pray for me.
Well, Jim, I will pray for you, but I'm thanking God that he sends you because I think you have a lot to give to his people. You know, we're called to nourish each other, and I think you're the man, the right man for the job. God love you, Jim.
God love you.
And your ministry, too.
And
don't forget, if anybody's listening to this, say a prayer for Jim.
And say a prayer for Father
all of
Ed.
Us. Yes.
Amen. Amen.
Up next, Michigan's native tribes call it Manuman, wild rice, sacred to First People and virtually wiped out by European settlers.
The importance of Manuman is just as important as trying to maintain our language. So we need to bring and maintain and keep that Manuman here because this is the only place on Mother Earth that it grows.
Reclaiming wild rice. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of Michigan's many natural resources, one that might not leap to mind is wild rice. But there's a rich tradition of wild rice in our state, especially for Michigan's first people, the Anishinaabeg tribes, who call it Manuman and who regard it as a sacred gift. European settlers all but wiped it out, but there's work afoot to restore and protect wild rice in Michigan. With us now is Barbara Barton, an endangered species biologist, whose book is Manuman, the Story of Wild Rice in Michigan. And we welcome Roger Labin with the Lac Vieux des Airs Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Roger, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here, to be along with my friend Barb.
It's great to be here, too.
Barb, I am betting that most of us didn't know, that rice has been grown in Michigan for how long?
Rice is a wild plant here, and so it's been here for probably thousands of years. And all my career as an endangered species biologist up until about 10 years ago, I didn't even know wild rice grew here, which I don't know how that happened. But yeah, most non-tribal people don't know that wild rice grows wild here. It's not farmed. It's not an agricultural crop here. It's wild.
Roger, tell us about that word, Manuman. What does it mean?
Manuman in a translation means the good seed. And the good seed, it can be as a medicine up until the point when you're processing it, when you put fire to it, then it turns into a food. And it's become a staple food for the Three Fires Society.
So, yeah, I want to have you take us more deeply into just what Manuman means to Native American communities in Michigan, because it certainly, you mentioned food, but I certainly hear cultural importance and spiritual importance.
Right. And my mentor, Naganosh, that was my uncle, he was telling me that to him, the wild rice beds were Gitagon Manitou, Garden of the Spirits, or Spirit Garden. And so that comes from the migration story. Prior to the colonizers, or the Westerners, as before they arrived and set foot on the East Coast, the Three Fires Society, which is Ottawa, Potawatomi, and Chippewa, formed the Madewin Society. And we were actually located up at the mouth of the St. Lawrence Seaway. And a woman had this dream that where she was standing on the back of a turtle, which symbolized an island. And she was facing that westward direction. So she went to the spiritual leaders and wanted an interpretation of that dream. And what became of that dream was the Creator gave the spiritual leaders the seven prophecies. So the first and the third prophecies are very, very important to the Native American people, because the first prophecy said that we needed to move, because if we didn't move, we were going to be faced with death and destruction. And so the third prophecy says that we would move in that direction, and we needed to follow the cowrie shell, and we were to follow that to the land where the food that grows on the water. And it needs to be said that this area in the Great Lakes Basin is the only place that this manumen grows on Mother Earth. And the prophecy says that when we find this food that grows on the water, we will know we will be home. And so this wild rice has been a very, very important to who we are today. And so now we are very, very adamant about the restoration and bringing it back.
Before we get to the restoration, Barb, let's talk about what happened to the wild rice in Michigan. How abundant was it at its peak?
In Michigan, it was really abundant. We had vast rice beds at the mouths of some of our rivers as they outletted into the Great Lakes. Some of them were literally thousands of acres in size, which is hard for me to visualize today. Particularly in Lake Erie, the mouth of the River Raisin, up the Detroit River, up into Lake St. Clair, even up into Lake Huron. The city of Benton Harbor is actually built where a rice bed used to be. So most of those river mouths had rice beds.
And how did European settlers regard this plant?
As a nuisance most of the time. It was used somewhat by food for food in the early days in the fur trade era. People would trade with the Anishinaabeg people for rice. But for the most part, as colonization happened in the state, it was regarded as an impediment, especially to travel when people were trying to move upstream, like in the Saginaw River Valley. You'll read lots of accounts of folks getting stuck in the rice that's growing and choking off the river, as they would say, and they wouldn't be able to get their boats up through it.
So where do we stand today with how much wild rice is in our state?
We've lost all the large beds. We have one large bed remaining, many beds, but one large one that's about 700 acres in size at Tawas Lake. The other beds are very small. Usually, I think there's maybe a handful that are 100 acres, maybe 200 acres, but for the most part, they're just little patchy areas here and there in inland lakes and streams.
So what happened to get us from this great abundance to almost gone?
Well, there were two things that happened almost simultaneously. Well, actually, three things. In the 1800s, in the early 1800s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had this plan to dredge all the rivers in order to allow for the transport of goods in and out of ports. So they didn't have any regard for the wild rice beds or any other marshes that were there. So they straightened and channelized and dredged and filled. With that came a lot of development along the shoreline of the rivers, particularly when you look at southeast Michigan. So you had a lot of pollutants then going in, a lot of sedimentation going out into the bay. Also, what happened at that in the 1800s, you had the logging era, and that did a tremendous amount of ecological devastation in terms of erosion, running logs down the rivers, which, of course, scoured and the mills that they built on the shoreline and the railroads that they put in through the marshes to move logs. There was a lot of impact there as well. Then you had, it went from there to, we had a malaria epidemic in the United States in the 1800s, and in Michigan, in particular, in the southern half of the Lower Peninsula. And so they were trying to drain all of the, quote, swamps in the state. They didn't know what caused malaria back in those days. Mm-hmm. They thought it was vapors or gas coming from something, and it was always related to marshes. But then in the late 1800s in Europe, they discovered that the mosquito was the vector. And it took a few years for that information to come to Michigan, but they realized that they had to be much more diligent and much more precise on how they drained water, because before they'd leave a little bit of puddles here or there, mm-hmm. didn't matter for malaria, but in their minds. But then they found out the mosquitoes could breed in little pools of water. So they really started making a concerted effort to make ditches wider and deeper, which those ditches are still here today when you drive around and see them.
And Roger, as this was all happening, what was that like from the tribal point of view? When as you saw all of it, as the tribe saw all of this dredging and all of this going on, how did that hit the tribes?
They were actually, you know, mourning, because to us that Manuman has a spirit, and that Manuman was crying for help. But at the same time, the U.S. government was trying to assimilate the Native Americans. So this was the time that, you know, boarding schools and a lot of other things, they were trying to put a lot of the Native Americans on reservations and trying to control them and take them away from the sites that were sacred. And currently, I'm not aware of any of the federally recognized tribes in Michigan that does not have one form of restoration effort going. There are various stages. Some are a little ahead of others, but it's that teaching and that importance and bringing that back to who we are, because Manuman is part of our identity of who we are.
And Barbara, as an endangered species biologist, give us a sense of where are the most successful restoration projects for Manuman in Michigan right now.
Nottawaseppi Huron Band has been doing a great job working on restoration of the state threatened species, which is Zizania aquatica, or the river rice. They've been working on that for several years now, trying to bring it back to their reservation. Of course, Roger's tribe, with his uncle's work starting and Roger continuing and others in his tribe, they've been able to bring rice back to Lac Vieux d'Isere itself after it was wiped out pretty much by a dam that was put in the late 1800s for logging. MDOT also is incorporating wild rice into some of the wetland mitigation that they're doing. And there was a planting done at a site near Grand Rapids last year, and it seems like every seed sprouted. The rice bed is very lush. The plants are about 8 feet tall now. And so those are three examples of successful restoration. It takes multiple years of seeding, and there's a lot of pressure on restoration efforts, things that work against you. It's important to have the buy-in of people who live nearby. Most of the rice beds are located off of tribal lands, and a lot of people who don't understand Manuman view it as a weed. So you want to get buy-in from people in the area so that they don't try to kill it off once it becomes established.
And in your book, Barbara, you talk about TEK, traditional ecological knowledge. What is it and how does it fit into this reclamation?
The traditional ecological knowledge is the knowledge that Roger and the other tribal folks hold. Generations and generations of experience, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years of experience living with the land and understanding how everything works together that the colonizing people don't have. We've been here a few hundred years and have a completely different relationship. Many have a completely different relationship with the land. So the traditional ecological knowledge has been gleaned from that close relationship, and the tribal folks have an understanding of the relationship, much more so than the non-tribal people.
There's a line in the foreword to your book, Barbara, that jumped out at me, and I'm going to read it. Wild rice seed is structurally designed to embed itself within a willing substrate. Similarly, there's something about the spirit of Manuman that seems designed to embed itself within a willing soul. Mm-hmm. How have you felt that work in you?
It's a spiritual thing. It's the only way I can put it. The first time I went out into a rice bed, it just touched my heart. The spirit of the place, the beauty of the plant, the significance of it, knowing how important it is to the tribes, and that's why they're here today, because of Manuman. It just really touched me in a deep place. And the other beings that live in the rice bed, you know, there's always eagles out when we're out ricing. There's usually ducks in the rice bed and dragonflies. And just the life that's teeming in these beds just really touches you. And everyone I know who's gone into a rice bed experiences the same thing. And you just want to protect it.
And Roger, as you hear someone who is not Native American feeling this, what does this say to you, this kind of cooperation in trying to reclaim Manuman? What does that mean in a broader picture for Native communities in Michigan?
Well, I think that, you know, the sensitivity that the non-tribal people can have towards this sacred resource, and we consider it a gift from the Creator. And one of the things that, you know, in our TEK is that, you know, a lot of people, I believe, have the misconception even when they are, brought to, know what wild rice is. It's difficult for them to understand that wild rice is an annual plant and that each plant only has a one-year life cycle. And so that gets us into one of the things we can talk about later is one of the challenges in trying to reestablish a wild rice bed is trying to develop that seed bank. And so when Barb, I've shown Barb how, she can feel like us and how I feel towards that. But sometimes it can be like a two-edged sword is because some of the things that happen is that even though we do restore some things, the lack of regulations and a management plan on the resource can actually impact the success of any efforts to restore it.
So that sounds like something that you need to look to Lansing to, or where do you need to go, Barb, to be able to kind of clear the way for a successful restoration so that you could actually have enough wild rice to really harvest and really use, and you could feel confident about it?
One of the really fantastic things that's happened over the last couple of years that Roger and I used to talk about years ago, we dreamed of having a state wild rice team where you had the tribes and various agencies in state government and maybe even federal governmental agencies sitting at the table talking about Mahnomen and how we can best protect it and conserve it and bring it back in places where it's appropriate. And actually 2 years ago, that happened. A state wild rice team formed. And they continue to this day working on legal questions, regulations. There's all kinds of subcommittees that are focused on different aspects of protecting the rice. And so I think because we have everyone at the table now, there's a lot of forward momentum, and people are working really, really hard to make it a priority.
And is there any being harvested to the point where people could buy it?
There are a couple lakes that people are harvesting on, maybe three or four places they're harvesting on, but it's a wild plant. And I always tell people that wild plants are not meant to be commodities. They're wild plants that are gifts from the Creator for us to eat, to feed our families or feed the elder or feed the community. The tribal folks, if they are harvesters, not everybody's a wild rice harvester. So up at Rogers Tribe, for instance, they can go out and harvest and get a good amount of rice, and then they might sell some of it to supplement their income. But we really don't have the big, vast rice beds like they have in Wisconsin or Minnesota where it can afford to be sold more. That's just my personal opinion about it.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to add to what Barb had said is that one of the things the Wild Rice Initiative is actually working towards is to try to bring the state of Michigan up with like Wisconsin and Minnesota, where in Minnesota, wild rice is actually designated as the state grain. And even though it's a grass, I mean, the Minnesota has so much respect for Mahnomen and plant and everything else. The state of Michigan needs to do that to enable them to do a lot of the other things to preserve and the things that the initiative is trying to do. So even to do inventory, to try to take an inventory. Like right now, one of the biggest influences or impacts on wild rice is because there is no status on it. And so it doesn't enable us to move forward to try to protect it. So there is a lot at stake to trying to make sure that we maintain this in Michigan.
It is a very fascinating and a rich story that I think many people had no idea, and thanks to you, we are much more informed. Roger Lebin with the Lac Vieux des Airs Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and Barbara Barton, whose book is Mahnomen, The Story of Wild Rice in Michigan. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Stateside's executive director is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.